It's been popular in recent years to talk about Congress failing to take bold action on an issue. Kicking the can down the road is the phrase that pays. But while we can blame Congress now for the things it now does do, the fact is the people who created Congress and the rest of our federal system are partly responsible. Didn't the writers of the Constitution kick the can down the road on slavery and other matters? Oh, yes, say the husband and wife author team of Cynthia and Sanford Levinson. They are the co-authors of a book for younger readers called Fault Lines in the Constitution: The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. Sanford Levinson is an American legal scholar. He's a professor at the University of Texas in the Law School and Department of Government. He writes nonfiction books for adults about government. Cynthia Levinson writes books for young readers. She is a former teacher and educational policy consultant and researcher. And again, it is Sanford Levinson we have on the program today. Hi, Sandy. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So what made you guys decide to take up this project together?
Well, the quick answer to that is Cynthia's editor at Peachtree Publisher, because she had published a couple of books with them, that one of which deservedly won a number of prizes. And so she's a very skilled children's author, and her editor had read some books of mine that had been targeted for an adult audience that were making the claim that there were significant defects in the Constitution itself. And so it was our editor, Kathy Landwehr, who said, you know, there's really no book available for teenagers that offers a truly serious discussion of the constitutional structures, and you're the team that could do it. So we did it.
Is this a particularly good moment in history to explain the Constitution, warts and all, to younger people?
I think so. I have been a critic of the Constitution, really, for probably a couple of decades. But quite frankly, for most of those decades, I felt as if I were swimming upstream or even trying to go up a waterfall, in that Americans are just trained in some way to venerate the Constitution and to believe that it is faultless, and that if there are any problems, it's because we have lousy leaders. I think that the events of the last year, and certainly the Trump presidency, have made people more receptive to at least discussing the possibilities that part of the problem is the Constitution itself.
Do you take some comfort in knowing that the great framers did not have all the answers in their day?
They didn't think they had all the answers. That if you read them, they knew that they were doing the best they could for 1787. The amendment article, that is Article 5 in the Constitution, which provides for the possibility of amendment, is a testament to the fact that they weren't confident they had gotten it completely right. In fact, I edited a book back in 1995 called Responding to Imperfection, and I got the title from a letter of George Washington to his nephew, where he says, in effect, look, we know this is imperfect, and we're counting on future generations to draw from the lessons of experience, which is a favorite phrase of James Madison and Alexander Hamilton. So I think that the framers would have been a combination of surprised and appalled to be turned into the equivalent of demigods whose achievement in 1787 really can't be questioned. They expected an ongoing dialogue, and I think they would have been surprised by how relatively little change there's been in the national Constitution since then.
They did, after all, say a more perfect union, not that we'd ever actually reach perfection, but that we could keep trying is certainly what it seems like there. Let's go back and talk about the reason for assembling in 1787, because there were a lot of things that the Articles of Confederation just couldn't do. I mean, the federal government couldn't levy federal taxes, for example. What was the result happening there?
Right. I think it was Jess Unruh, the former Speaker of the California House, who probably 50 years ago or so said that money is the mother's milk of politics. And it's even more seriously, it's the mother's milk of government. if you can't finance government, you don't have a government. And under the Articles, the way the national government, such as it was, got money was through a so-called requisition system, where they basically sent out letters to the various states saying, this is how much you should pony up. But it's by 1786, the states simply were not ponying up. There was almost literally no money coming into the federal treasury, and that made, you know, the basic conduct of government nearly impossible. The other thing that people were certainly concerned about was the vulnerability of the new United States to a variety of foreign and more local threats. So you needed a defense force, and that, again, needs money. So the very first Federalist, written by Alexander Hamilton, begins with the sentence saying, look, all of us agree that the government just isn't working. And later on in the Federalist, in number 15, there will be a reference to the imbecilic nature of the national government. And so that's the reason, basically, that you had the convention in 1787.
Well, strong words, the imbecilic nature of the federal government under the Articles of Confederation. I think people have said it since the Constitution was formed as well. But we're talking about the Constitution and some of the built-in flaws. Sanford Levinson is the co-author with his wife, Cynthia Levinson, of Fault Lines in the Constitution. We'll come back and talk more about the work there. And you can join the conversation as well when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is University of Texas Professor Sanford Levinson. He is in the Law School and Department of Government. He writes nonfiction books for adults about government. His wife tends to write for younger readers, and they joined forces on a book called Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. So even the framers of the Constitution were not demigods. They were people, and they kicked the can down the road in some ways as well. We're hearing how in this hour, and you can join us as we get into the discussion further. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we're just talking about Alexander Hamilton, talking about the imbecilic federal government under the Articles of Confederation. It was basically a beggar government asking the states for money, which they stopped delivering after a while. The very concept, though, Sandy, of capital A Americans, did it even exist in 1787?
With some people, probably most strongly in somebody like Alexander Hamilton. The play Hamilton is built around the notion that he was an immigrant who, although he obviously lived in New York and was an important figure in New York, he really had a conception of America. But a lot of other people, it was still very much up for grabs. Thomas Jefferson considered himself primarily a Virginian. John Adams considered himself primarily a person from Massachusetts, and the great challenge facing the United States after achieving independence, frankly, was remolding people's identities from being primarily citizens of their state to feeling themselves to be members of the national community, and quite frankly, we're still engaged in some way in that struggle. We killed 750,000 people between 1861 and 1865, in part because Robert E. Lee, when push came to shove, considered himself a Virginian more than an American. And that is an enduring problem in American federalism. It's so long as people feel attached to their states and they don't like what the national government is doing, there's going to be a tension there. But in 1787, to get back to your point, I think it was relatively rare for people to say, you know, if you are at a cocktail party or the equivalent of a cocktail party and you're asked, well, what are you? I think relatively few people would have said, I'm an American. I think the answer would have been, I'm a Virginian, I'm from Connecticut, though I wish this new government well. The primary identity was still a state identity.
Hmm. And the process of the Constitutional Convention of 1787, not the open government we talk about having now, how much did the public know about the process and how much uproar was there about the outcome?
The answer to your first question is easy. They knew nothing about it. It was drafted entirely in secret, and to an extent that I think is literally unimaginable to us today, in an age of Twitter and leaks, et cetera, the people who showed up in Philadelphia made a promise to one another to keep whatever happened, you know, what happens in Philadelphia stays in Philadelphia. And even some people who walked out of the convention because they didn't like what they saw nonetheless kept their word. So when the Constitution was made public in September 17th, 1787, it was a real shock. And one of the responses, particularly from people who didn't like the new Constitution, and it was a touch and go whether the Constitution would be ratified, they described the people in Philadelphia as having created a consolidated government that took power away from the states and shifted it in a very, very dramatic way to this new, untried national level of government. And they were basically correct.
So there's a great simplicity, obviously, to the approach in this book, given that it is written for younger readers. I really like thinking of the three branches of government as rock, paper, scissors, in a sense that they can all, each one can cancel the other up to a point. There was precedent for that division, you point out, on this continent, though, and that's a really fascinating point.
Well, most of the colonies had legislatures, and in most cases they were bicameral. They had governors, but they were appointed by the king. But nonetheless, the royal governor was not responsible to the legislature. And there was the development of a quasi-independent judiciary, but it was still a judiciary appointed by the king. So the people drafting the Constitution, or more to the point, the people who drafted state constitutions, and one of the points of our book is that America is full of constitutions. Every state has its own constitution. And in fact, in Oregon, one of the most important judges in the 20th century was Hans Lindy, who was on the Oregon Supreme Court for a number of years. And Justice Lindy made a very, very important point over and over again that lawyers should begin with the Oregon Constitution and then move on to the U.S. Constitution. So if you look at state constitutions, you discover that most of them were bicameral. They were developing independent judiciaries, and also all of them decided to have governors. I personally regret that not a single state experimented with a form of parliamentary governance. But when people got to Philadelphia in 1787, they came from states that really already had established more or less the kind of pattern that we're familiar with. That being said, it's important to note that Pennsylvania, which was one of the largest states, was unicameral. There was a one-house legislature, and there were a few people in Philadelphia who thought that would be a good idea for the national government, but obviously that was rejected. And in fact, Pennsylvania changed to a bicameral government in 1790. The only one of the 50 states today that is unicameral is Nebraska, and they chose to do that in 1934. One of the features of our book, incidentally, is that it has a comparative focus. So after talking about the U.S. Constitution, there are sections in every chapter. Well, are there other ways? And some of the time we say, well, you know, other countries do it this way, but we spend a lot of pages, relatively speaking, talking about how various states do things quite differently from the national government. And, you know, one of the most dramatic illustrations is that in most states, and I think this is true in Oregon as well, judges are elected, whereas at the national level, very obviously, judges are appointed.
Right, yes, they are elected in Oregon, although often a judge will leave before the term is up and there'll be an appointment, and then the next election that person will run. The book is called Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. We're talking about the things that are sort of baked into the Constitution that influence still the way the system works now, and the things that are not necessarily in the Constitution as well. Cynthia Levinson and Sanford Levinson, husband and wife, worked on it together. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3767. 60 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And bam, we start chapter one with a lynching. What does that teach us about the Constitution, Sandy?
Well, it's a very dramatic story. Lynchings were a horribly significant part of American history from roughly the 1870s, actually, into the 1940s and even 50s. In the 1920s, a bill was introduced into Congress by a Republican member of the House from St. Louis, and it was supported by Warren Harding, the Republican president, to make a federal crime out of lynching. It didn't go anywhere, and it didn't go anywhere because of filibusters in the Senate. There were repeated efforts to pass a federal anti-lynching bill, all of which failed because of the Senate filibuster. So this is an unusually dramatic way, we thought, of making the point that we have a system of government in which there are all sorts of veto points that make it very, very difficult to pass legislation in the first place. And with regard to civil rights legislation in particular, in the Senate, before the great transformation generated by the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the Senate had enough white Southern Democrats, many of whom were out-and-out racists, some of whom might privately have not been that racist, but nonetheless knew what their constituents want, so they were able to block these bills. We end that chapter with a story in which the Senate, I think in 2005 or so, formally apologized for not ever passing an anti-lynching bill, and in fact blocking it, because it had passed the House, and in many cases it had the support of the president, beginning with Warren Harding in 1921 or 1922. Even that apology only got 80 votes. So there were 20 senators, even into the 21st century, who were unwilling to apologize for the fact that the Senate had blocked this bill because of the filibuster. So it's a very dramatic illustration of the importance not only of bicameralism, that in order to win in the legislation game, you have to prevail in both houses, not just in one house, but also that the Senate operates under its own rules, and those rules continue to include the filibuster, the ability of a minority to block legislation.
But the Constitution is actually silent on the filibuster, right? There is no mention of it there?
Well, what the Constitution says is that each house can make its own rules. And that's sensible because there have to be rules for any sort of body. I'm quite confident that nobody in 1787 believed that one of the rules would be that you need need a supermajority in order to pass legislation in the Senate. The Constitution specifies when you need supermajorities. You need a supermajority to ratify treaties. You need a supermajority to convict somebody who's been impeached by the House. You need a supermajority of states in order to amend the Constitution. But I think it's fair to say that if you had asked any of the framers in 1787, well, how would legislation be passed? They would have said, well, be passed by majorities. What else would be feasible or correct in a democracy? But the Senate has established so-called Rule 22, this institution called the filibuster, which they've changed over time, so they've gotten rid of it, for example, with regard to presidential appointments, but it's still alive and well with regard to legislation. And as I say, we began with lynching because it's an unusually dramatic example. But one of the points we make in the book, and this is certainly true today, is that there are certainly times when political liberals have been delighted that the Senate can block legislation that the House has passed and is supported by a majority of the Senate. So, you know, the real point is that the difficulty of passing legislation. And so ideally what we hope that the students who will read the book, and especially if they're assigned it in classes, our hope is that they'll actually argue with one another about the merits of the filibuster and whether in the 21st century we are well served by the filibuster. We also raise very, very real questions about the Senate itself. James Madison did not like the Senate insofar as it gave equal representation to Delaware and Virginia.
So little bitty states get as many votes as very big states.
You know, the most dramatic illustration is California and Wyoming, because California has roughly 70 times the population of Wyoming. And Madison referred to the Senate as a lesser evil. The evil was this huge disparity in population with equal voting power. What made it, though, a lesser, the greater evil would have been no constitution at all. So just as some anti-slavery people made compromises with slave owners in the original constitution, Madison made a compromise that he really didn't like at all with Delaware and the other small states, because the alternative would have been no constitution. But he never had a good word to say about the equality of voting power in the Senate.
Sanford Levinson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, co-author with Cynthia Levinson, his wife, Will, Fault Lines in the Constitution. Here is a call from Ann in Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. So I've been watching politics since 1948, when I was 6 years old, the Truman and election. So anyway, what I've seen in those years is the increasing role of money in politics. And it looks to me as if the Democratic Party is at least half owned by billionaires, and the Republican Party is owned completely by billionaires, who use racism, sexism, homophobia, voter suppression, and gerrymandering to keep their power. So is this at all of concern to you? Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Ann. Appreciate that.
I think we're almost exactly the same ages. I'm probably 1 year older than you, because I was seven in 1948. I can agree with much of what you said. We have a chapter in our book on gerrymandering and on possible ways to alleviate the genuine and deep costs of the way congressional districts and state legislative districts are drawn. We don't in the book address the role of money in politics, in part, frankly, because that could be alleviated if the Supreme Court simply changed its mind. What our book concentrates on are deep structures of the Constitution that aren't really subject, when all is said and done, to litigation. That you can't go into a court and say, Your Honor, it's just unfair that Wyoming has the same voting power as California. Or to say, you know, it's really a problem that we can't vote no confidence in a president in whom we've lost confidence, or we can't try to recall a president in whom we've lost confidence the way California did. What you have to do would be to amend the Constitution. So even if I do agree with you about the pathological role played by money, but what I would argue is that that's not baked into the Constitution.
It's something we could change through legal action and certainly through the Supreme Court reversing Citizens United. Back with Sanford Levinson and Fault Lines in the Constitution in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the flaws baked into our system by the way the Constitution was written. It, too, was a compromise, as political compromises are necessary to carry legislation forward in this day and age. Sanford Levinson and Cynthia Levinson, husband and wife, wrote the book for younger viewers or readers called The Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We did have a little discussion a moment ago, Sandy, about gerrymandering. And yes, Elbridge Gerry, for whom it is named, did have a hard G in his name. He was the fifth vice president of the United States, so this is not a new practice. But has it become more refined in our time?
Oh, yeah. That the modern computer makes it astonishingly easy to break down potential votes, even not simply at a precinct level, but at a block-by-block level. What Elbridge Gerry was able to do in Massachusetts in 1812 was, you know, hunch. This is the way the farmers would vote. This is the way the people in Boston might vote. It's today, people don't talk that way. They look at very sophisticated computer printouts, and it really has become a process of legislators choosing their voters.
So I'll draw the lines around the people who will likely elect me.
Exactly, exactly. In fact, there's a very good article yesterday, I think it was, in the Washington Post about the sophisticated techniques that are available. And so the most important case before the United States Supreme Court by far this coming year will be one challenging gerrymandering in Wisconsin and saying that the Supreme Court really should try to rein that in. Incidentally, if my wife were here, she would mention that it is a dispute within the family whether it should be gerrymandering or gerrymandering. Most people say Jerry, but Elbridge Gerry did pronounce his name with a hard G, so I'm a hard, you know, hard and fast gerrymanderer.
Okay, I just looked up that very same thing, so I'm trying to get in line here with the gerrymandering part of things. So this is obviously in a section of the, well, not obviously, but it's in a section of the Bush book called "Can You Hear Me?" about citizen input, and obviously gerrymandering can make it different how things are reflected between the populace that is represented and the people doing the representing. Some interesting math, obviously, on determining population. We had the three-fifths rule that every slave counted as three-fifths of a person. But some changes along the way. What was the Apportionment Act of 1842?
That required single-member districts. Until then, states could come to their own conclusion on how to elect their representatives. So to take an extreme example, if a given state were assigned 10 representatives, it could, if it wished, say that all the representatives will be elected at large. And that would mean, in effect, that a 51% majority of Whigs or Democrats in 1842 could elect all 10 of the representatives. So the 1842 Act was a way to eliminate that possibility. I mean, this is the way we elect electors. It's a winner-take-all, and it means that 51% of the voters can get 100% of California's 54, 55 electoral votes. And there are a lot of people who think that's just undemocratic and ought to be challenged. But say that's how we could elect representatives back in 1842. So Congress said, you can't do that. And then Congress said it again during the 1960s. So this means that every single member of the House of Representatives is elected in a single-member district. And that is what makes line drawing every 10 years such a freighted act. One of the things we talk about in the book, and this is something I personally favor very strongly, is requiring larger states, and larger in this context could mean states with more than six representatives, to divide themselves up into multi-member districts elected on the basis of proportional representation. So simply to give a concrete example, Texas, where we spend most of the year, has 36 representatives. So you could divide Texas into six districts with six representatives apiece, elected on a proportional representation basis. This means, frankly, that a Republican or two could be elected from the metropolitan Austin area, where I'm from, or the metropolitan Houston area. And it also means that a Democrat or two could be elected from West Texas, where, and it would pretty much eliminate the incentive to engage in gerrymandering. We really do seem to be convinced that the only way to elect representatives is through single-member districts. And I would like to see, and one of the things the book does, is to encourage, beginning with the kids who read the book, but quite frankly, we hope that some of the parents might pick up the book as well and kind of get hooked on it. One of the reviews we've gotten says, though written for children, it really has something for adults as well. And I think that's true. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I personally would love to see all Americans talking about more than we do is whether we might not change the way we elect representatives to eliminate this really dreadful incentive to engage in ultra-partisan gerrymanders.
Huh, that would get around some of the cherry-picking anyway. But here's a call from Jeff in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sanford Levinson, the co-author of Fault Lines in the Constitution.
Good morning. And, I really hope that you're successful on getting rid of the incentive for gerrymandering, because it is very detrimental to our democratic process. But my comment is that I find that a lot of people who tout the Constitution as this set in stone kind of thing, that they cherry pick. They pick whatever part they like, and they kind of ignore what they don't like, or they go after one particular word or phrase and kind of try to interpret it in some way that's kind of sometimes very odd. Mm-hmm. And an example of that, I think, might be, this last, the Mitch McConnell blocking the Supreme Court nominee from President Obama, so that, for a year, more than a year, that struck me as rather unconstitutional, although it was perfectly legal according to Senate rules, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
All right. Thanks for the call, Jeff. Appreciate that.
I certainly think the caller was correct in saying that there's a lot of cherry picking in terms of what people say about the Constitution. I would also put it within the context that most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time when people talk about the Constitution, they tend to talk about their favorite rights. So some people will talk about freedom of speech and freedom of the press. Other people will talk about the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms. There are relatively few dinner table conversations about the hardwired structural aspects, like equal voting power in the Senate, precisely because they're not going to be litigated. But now, to talk about your caller's point, and that is Senator McConnell and Judge Garland, you know, there's a lot of controversy about whether or not the Senate behaved constitutionally. My own view is that they did, that Senate says that the president nominates, but it's up to the Senate to give advice and consent. I don't think anybody imagined that an opposition party would do what McConnell did, but I think he was taking advantage of the rules of the Senate. And I think it's more a sign of the polarization and the breakdown of ordinary rules of courtesy. You know, the fact is they could have voted Garland down mm-hmm. after giving him a hearing, and nobody could say, oh, that's outrageous. They didn't even give him a hearing. And that was simply, you know, to say that it was impolite is much too mild. But it is a sign of just the degree of polarization and what can happen when everybody tries to take advantage of the possibilities that the Constitution allows.
Well, the Constitution does not say, it does not say, for example, you know, that we need to act upon a judicial nomination within a certain amount of time, which is what might have undone McConnell. But that's not in there, which brings us back to, I guess, a more general question, which is, are the abilities of any branch of government to block the moves of another a bug or a feature?
That's a great question. I think that at any given moment, the answer to your question would depend on your own politics. So, for example, those of us who liked Obamacare were just fine with President Obama vetoing some repeal provisions passed by Congress. At other times, one could be outraged by the presidential veto or be outraged by what the Senate does or doesn't do, as with the anti-lynching legislation. So one of the things we suggest, and I say this theme also of some other things I've written for in more adult books, is that you have to look at vetoes or the way bicameralism works over time, over the whole 200 years, so over the last 20 or 30 or 40 years, because I think that there is no perfect system of government. Whatever system or whatever set of rules you adopt, you're going to find yourself at least at a certain moment saying, gee, I wish we had the other set of rules. And so what you have to do is to make an informed judgment based on the lessons of experience as to what social scientists would call the frequency distribution. That how often is it that all of these veto points will block good legislation as against blocking bad legislation, if you believe, as I personally do, that more often the veto points have worked to block good legislation, even though on occasion they've also blocked bad legislation, I'd be willing to roll the dice and simply pay the cost of getting some bad legislation in order to get good legislation that now is blocked. But other people could say, no, I read the record differently. But I think that's the way one has to argue on the basis of our collective experience over a number of years before you can say, well, systemically, is this a feature or a bug? I was surprised in writing some earlier stuff of mine to come to the conclusion that overall, I believe the presidential veto and the fact that it's extraordinarily difficult to override a presidential veto, you need two-thirds of each house, is more of a bug than a feature. But, you know, I've got friends who disagree with me, and so reasonable people can certainly disagree on this. And as I say, a principal hope behind our book is to provoke conversation, including ultimately conversations between the kids and their parents.
Well, we've certainly had a conversation here today. The book is called Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. It's by Cynthia Levinson and Sanford Levinson. Sanford Levinson joined us today. Sandy, thank you.
Oh, thank you.